where's your... No. So, Michelle. Michelle. I want to talk to Michelle. There you go. I want to talk to Michelle.
All right, we're going to try to...
No, it's not.
Oh, I'm looking at the wrong one, maybe.
Hello?
There you go.
Which one is this?
The light.
Oh, that's the light. That's actually pretty funny. Okay, we're getting that out of here. All right, good evening. We are here this evening. We are convening the December 2nd, 2015 meeting of the Municipal Courts Task Force. We have here a full agenda for this evening, including two important speakers, as all of our speakers are. We do have a slightly smaller panel because of a vacation and an illness. But the folks that we do have here, let me introduce the panel. To my right, we have the Honorable Glenn Galbraith, Cuyahoga Heights Village Justice. We have Liz Thomas, the Supervisor for the Town of Ulysses. We have the Honorable Betty Poole, the Enfield Town Justice. I'm Ray Schlatter, and to my left is Mark Solomon. We are just two attorneys here in town. We also have... we expect Jason Leifer will be joining us later, and excused are Gwen Wilkinson and Scott Miller, the Honorable Scott Miller, Ithaca City Court Judge, neither of whom were able to make it for legitimate reasons. All right, so first of all, we have the agenda before us. The most prominent part of the agenda is that we have Ms. Julia Hughes from the Assigned Counsel Program and Jim Baker, who will be addressing us, as well as Attorney Lance Salisbury. But before we get to that, let's just go through the other items. First of all, you have in front of you the minutes for the November 18th, 2015 meeting. May we have a motion to approve?
So moved.
Mark moves. Second?
I have a slight correction.
Okay, so Betty seconds and has a correction. Go ahead.
Yeah, Judge Chernish's spelling of his last name, and correct me if I'm wrong, Judge, it's C-H-E-R-N-I-S-H.
Correct.
That is correct. Good catch.
I have another couple corrections. On page 5,
alrighty.
About halfway down, is the word job, J-O-B. It should be judge.
Right. Very good.
And Judge Kakoma's name, I think, is misspelled at the bottom of page 5.
It is. It's a...
C-O-C-O-M-A?
Yeah, I think there might even be an extra C in there.
Two C. Three C's.
Three C's altogether,
okay.
I believe so. And by the way, if there are any other typos or things of that nature, feel free to pass them on to Joe. But substantively, if there are no other changes, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Thank you. Passes. We do have a period reserved at every meeting for public comment. This is an opportunity for members of the public to speak briefly about any of the issues that we are considering or any other issue that is relevant, and I would ask if any of the member wishes to speak. There are no members of the public who wish to speak this evening, although there are members of the public here, and we are grateful for your attendance. In terms of the chair's report, we did have a meeting. Joe and I met with Peter Lee and Rafi Stern, who are the two law students who have agreed to work with us. We met telephonically last Wednesday, and we have discussed a number of issues, but frankly, their initial task is to read everything, including the Dunn Report, and become familiar with everything that we have posted on our website. And then the intent is for this group to have a discussion, hopefully at our next meeting, which is on the 16th of December, and at that time try to focus on some of the issues that we would like to either get more research on or more data collected concerning which, and from there instruct our law students accordingly. So that's kind of where we are at this point, and I hope that we'll be able to accommodate them. They are anxious and eager, and they're willing to provide us with generally the equivalent of about 5 to 10 hours of time a week to do this, whatever work we would like of them. Otherwise, the only other points we have before you, I received a fax today from Liam Murphy, which I have photocopied and circulated to the panel, and have given to Joe, and he's going to post. We also have Lance Salisbury's written comments that were received by us, and thank you for getting those to us yesterday. So we've all had a chance to read those, and then which also will be posted. So that's all I have. Joe, any other?
No report tonight.
All right. So good. So at this point, what I'd like to do is to introduce Lance. Are you going to go first? Is that the idea?
I think Julia will.
Julia's going to go first. Jim's going to go first. All right. We have, I don't think these folks need an introduction, but we have Julia Hughes and Jim Baker from the Assigned Counsel Program. They have a presentation. They're well-known, respected, and with great affection and admiration in this community, and we'd love to hear what they have to say, followed by Lance Salisbury. Generally, what we do is the presentations are made, and then the board will pepper you with questions. So go ahead, please.
Yeah, I'm Jim Baker. As you all know, I'm interim supervising attorney of the Assigned Counsel Program at this point. I've held that position for all of a month and a half and have gotten a glimpse of some of how our program works. Julia has been program coordinator for as far back as I can remember, just about. She has the knowledge, she has the statistics, and I'm going to leave the bulk, if not all, of the presentation to Julia and the slides that she's prepared. I'll be available for questions if there are any after.
Thank you.
As most of you know, I'm Julia Hughes, the program coordinator for the Tompkins County Assigned Counsel Program. But I've also had other positions within the criminal justice system that has given me a different perspective on how things work. I started out as a receptionist in a local law firm. Then I was appointed as a town justice in a neighboring town. After that, I was a court clerk for a village justice who was also a lawyer, who I love dearly. After that, I was given the opportunity to be the coordinator of this program. Also, once I found out we were going to have three drug courts, I thought I should educate myself on addiction, so I went back to school. I am currently 6 credit hours away from being a credentialed alcohol and substance abuse counselor. In order to finish my degree, I must manage a case for an individual with substance abuse problems, but unfortunately, I seem to be conflicted out. As you can see, I have worked in this current system for a long time, approximately 32 years. I have sat here through every task force meeting, and I can tell you it pains me to hear the things that have been said. And I'm fighting a cold, so you're going to have to bear with me a little bit. I'm losing my voice.
We're very accommodating. Go ahead.
I respect most of the town justices and know the obstacles they face on a daily basis. I applaud their dedication to community and fair-mindedness. But unfortunately, this is also a position where ego and power have come into play with some. Some of the comments may have been blunt and hurtful, but all of them have been true and accurate. It is one thing to have a justice who does not understand the law, but we also must realize that the judge has the power to put someone in jail and to take away their liberty. When a person is put in jail, the collateral damage is widespread. He or she may lose their housing, their job, their social security benefits, their home, and something near and dear to me, their pets. And last but not least, their dignity. This is a powerful tool and one that should not be taken lightly, which is why our system needs a change. We need a dedicated court that will cover all jailable and bailable offenses and follow them through till the end of the action. Yes, I have heard that local justice courts are the courts of the people and the community, but it is not my experience that most people within the community know anything about the courts and what the judges are doing on the bench. Even Ms. Thomas have said you didn't really know what was going on. We had a city court judge position that was also going to be appointed, and when the mayor sat down to appoint the city court judge, the first thing she said was, "I really don't know what goes on in city court." She had no idea. She had to sit through a couple of sessions of court in order to know what she was looking at, and that was, she was shocked. She had no idea, and I think that's what happens in the general public. Unless that person is appearing before the court, there is usually no knowledge of the operations of the court and if it is working according to the law. I have also heard people testify here that we have had the system in place for over 200 years. Why change now? That is not a reason to keep the status quo. Another topic that has been widely discussed here is consistency and justice. That seems to mean different things to different people. To me, it means our court should be asking for reasonable bails and that the sentences should be consistent with the crime. Currently, that is not the case. Some of that has to do with the district attorney's office, but the end result lies with the justices. If you plead to a DWI offense in some courts, you are given probation or a conditional discharge. But in some courts, all DWI offenses must spend time in jail. I'm sorry to say that is not justice. It is a policy. There is data to support these facts, and I hope the committee will look into it. We are an innovative county with leaders who are not afraid to implement new initiatives. This is a place where a dedicated court would work. My staff has compiled some data to show you how the courts are currently scheduled. If you look at the PowerPoint screen above, this is the weekly court schedule by municipalities. As you have heard from many different parties, the Monday night court schedule is a problem. Our department usually has between 15 and 20 attorneys out that night to represent clients. But Wednesday is also a problem. We have two of the biggest justice courts meeting at the same time, which is right now. We have Town of Ithaca and Town of Dryden, Dryden being the biggest justice court in our county. But also keep in mind, while these courts are being held, county court and family court are also going on every day from 8:30 to 4:30. This is no small feat to keep all clients covered by attorneys on any given day. But it is not only a hardship for the attorneys, it is also a hardship for the clients. The bus systems do not conform to the court schedules, making transportation a problem for them. This is an area which needs to be looked at more closely and discussed with the different transportation organizations within our county. Slide 3 is a map to show you how many different directions the attorneys are going to on a Monday night. And sometimes an attorney may have to appear in more than one court. Sometimes maybe even three courts. Some judges are understanding of this dilemma and will make adjustments to their court schedules to handle the attorneys with many cases. But not all of the judges are willing to wait. Slide 4 is a breakdown of the costs associated with justice courts according to the law. The attorneys are entitled to payment for mileage, the time it takes to get back and forth to court, the time they actually appear in front of the judge, and the time it takes for the case to be called. So while they're sitting there waiting to be called, they are also billing their time. On pretrial nights, when the assistant district attorneys are present, the wait time may be anywhere from an hour to 3 hours at a cost of $60 to $75 per hour. When you have 15 to 20 attorneys in the audience waiting to be called, these figures can add up quickly. Slide 5 is a breakdown of the costs associated with Monday nights for time and travel. It's with all the courts, really. Every court, the distance which it is from the city of Ithaca, the time it takes, how much it costs per attorney. It does not include time waiting. Slide 6 is a breakdown of the costs associated with the courts. This gives you an idea how much it's costing county to cover all these courts. The mileage, the travel time, the court time, and the court time waiting is on their voucher. Slide 7 is a snapshot of the cost for Monday night. During this task force, I have heard many times that a district court would not be a cost saver. I disagree. Monday night alone costs almost $50,000 a year to cover the cost of travel and mileage, and that's just an estimate. To me, this is a fair amount of money that could be saved by having a central located court within the city, which is where most law offices are located. This figure does not cover the many hours that are spent in court waiting for the case to be heard. This figure could add another $50,000 or more to the total cost of Monday. Would a dedicated court cut down on the amount of hours an attorney is in court? Yes. An efficiently run single court where cases are scheduled at various times of the day rather than all at the same time would certainly be a cost saver for the taxpayers of Tompkins County. So if you, that's just, I did it for 48 weeks because of the holidays on Monday that the courts have, and that is just travel. Like I said, travel and time, no waiting. To switch topics a bit, in May of 2014, our program changed completely with the initiation of counsel at first appearance. It was a Court of Appeals decision which stated that for all clients, an attorney should be present at the first appearance in court. Our supervising attorney at the time, Wesley McDermott, and I came up with a countywide system to try to cover all arraignments 24 hours a day, every day. We devised a calendar by assigning a different attorney for a 24-hour period, one day a month. This includes all holidays and snowstorms. On slide number 8, you can see how many after-hours arraignments we have had up until August 31st, 2015. This is only counsel at first arraignment. That's it.
How do we break out after-hours arraignments from scheduled arraignments during regular court time?
An after-hours arraignment is considered when normal court is not in session.
And all of these shown on this slide are that?
Yes, sir.
You can, which slide is that, Julia? Is it the one with the blue on it or the one with the green on it?
It's broken down, and the blue is the first part of the year, and then the second part is from June until August.
But the last one, it says counsel at first appearance initiative 519-2014 to...
That combines.
Yes.
That combines them all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
mm-hmm.
And those yes. are all after-hours arraignments.
All after-hours arraignments. None during regular court. If city court calls at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a Tuesday, even though they've had court on Wednesday the next day, we count that as an after-hours arraignment. There's not an attorney there that's going to be scheduled there, so we consider that an after-hours arraignment. On slide number 8, you can see how many after-hours arraignments we've had up until August 31st that our office is aware of. We broke it down by courts, by crime, and the result of the arraignment. We think it is cutting down on jail cases, but we have no way of knowing. We will compare data once we have a few years of data in place. We have heard from OAR that bail seemed to be lower and more reasonable, and there seems to be more people being released instead of going to the jail. I have also spoken to some town justices, and they are saying that they feel, because an attorney there, it is easier to determine bail because they can talk to the attorney. It's a very high emotional time. The person sometimes couldn't talk to the judge without being upset or is maybe incapacitated, and having an attorney there has seemed to have helped that process along. Counsel at first appearance has by no means been perfect. Unfortunately, we live in the world of cell phones, and some of our attorneys have not had cell service, which sometimes make it hard for the court to contact them. Where I live in the metropolis of West Danby, I don't have cell service. So it's very hard for people to reach me. And unfortunately, that is the case of some of our attorneys. And some of them, I would say the most of them, do not have landlines anymore. They just have cell phones. But while it is easy to blame the waiting on the defense attorney, law enforcement also has trouble getting the justices to come in for after hours. One person in the court system told me that a few weeks ago on a Friday night, six judges had to be called before one was found for a felony arraignment. I know this is a problem because all arraignments come across my desk and it is the same judges over and over being called in. Some judges who are on the bench currently hardly ever come out for arraignments. Some have never had a felony prelim hearing, and as you hear when the justices appeared, some have never had jury trials. These procedures are the backbone of our justice system. They are not things you should be doing once in a while, but on a regular basis. The laws of our land are too complex to be learned in a short period of time or with the help of a resource center. If we had a dedicated court open 24 hours a day with a scheduled judge, it would cut down on costs for the defense attorneys and would help law enforcement be out on the road more quickly. Slide 9 shows the breakdown of arraignments.
Julia, before you move off that slide. Oh, no, I'm sorry. This is the next one.
This one?
Yeah, the total, 514.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I thought you were talking about this one.
Yes, I am.
In connection with that in-jail bail, do you know or do you have the statistic as to how long it takes to get the bail posted for those folks to get out?
I do not. Sorry, I do not.
I would just want to make sure I understand this slide, Julia.
Okay.
With respect to jail status, in-jail bail and in-jail no bail, that is, correct me if I'm wrong, that is the result following the first, immediately following the first arraignment?
Yes, if it's an A2 okay. felony, a town justice can't set bail. If someone has two prior, yeah, that's what that means, no bail.
And so your results from a certain standpoint are very good if those numbers are to be credited. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes.
You have bail set in 54.47% of the cases, no bail set, yep. In 5.2, and then the breakdown, including
yes.
others who are released
yes,
at that time.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Except that the question is, and that's what I'm trying to get at, of that 54% where the bail is set, do we have any idea of the amount of that bail? How realistic is it? How long are those people in jail? Obviously, the court determined that it was a bailable offense, and it's a bailable individual, so.
I'm not given that information by the jail. I mean, I don't really know.
We'd have to look at those statistics to find out how long those folks may have been in before they were released.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
Slide number 9 shows the breakdown of arraignments by court. As expected, most of the after-hours arraignments have been done in city court. City court has a lockup located on premises, so the judge is called in for the next morning if the arraignment is after midnight. This system would also be helpful in Dryden, which is the next biggest court that we have.
Could you go back to that slide for just a second?
Sure.
Would it be possible for you to generate numbers that would parallel the numbers showing the number of first appearances in by court? Would it be possible for you to generate the numbers of cases during the same period of time for each of those courts? In other words, the first column at the top, Caroline, 17 first arraignments. I assume they occurred in Caroline. Isn't that what that means?
That means that they were arraigned in Caroline.
Yes.
That doesn't necessarily mean the court cases in Caroline.
I understand. But there were 17 arraignments in Caroline. Would it be possible to generate the number of cases located in Caroline during the same period?
I mean, the same period meaning that week, that month, that...
This is between 519 and, of 14 and August 31st of 2015.
During that time, how many criminal cases
yes,
they had?
Yes.
Sure. I think DCJS would have that, wouldn't they, Joe?
We'd have to look. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I think we already have that. I think we have annual reports. And don't they break them down by month?
I thought DCJS broke them down.
We'll look.
Okay.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Then finally, slide 10 shows a breakdown by crimes and the percentage of people who go to jail. As you can see, some courts have far fewer arraignments than others. If for some reason the task force does not recommend a district court, there are areas within our system that could be improved. First, oversight of the justice courts by a higher authority must be increased and improved. Second, a local procedure for the review of complaints would enhance justice, efficiency, and accountability. And finally, it would be beneficial to the taxpayers of some townships to consolidate their courts with another town or to only have one judge. It has been the practice in the justice courts to have two judges to cover conflicts. Really, there are not that many conflicts. If a judge has a conflict, it can always be assigned to another court. That number would not be significant. I have only had one case this year where both judges have been conflicted out of hearing a case. That case was then sent to city court, where it will now be heard. This number is not enough to overwhelm any court. This slide also shows that some courts send a higher percentage of people to jail than others at first arraignment for whatever reason. This data could also be looked at as an inconsistency in justice. We realize all cases are different, but these figures need to be looked at more closely to determine if our current system is fair. Finally, thank you for having me. I hope you find our information helpful and thought-provoking. If we can be of any further assistance or furnish you with any other data we have access to, please let us know and we will do our best to accommodate you. This is an important issue to all of us, and I thank you for being so dedicated to make the right decision for our community.
Thank you, Julia. I do have a question about this last slide. Is this, when you say in jail versus not in jail outcomes, you're referring to outcomes at first arraignment?
This is only first arraignment.
This is all first arraignment. Okay, thank you. And again, this just is a breakout of the data from the preceding three pages.
Correct.
That 514 to...
Yes, it's the breakdown of all that.
519 of 2014 to August 31st of 2015. Okay, thanks. All right, before we hear from Lance, do any of the panel members have questions about just kind of sorting out some of this data, and which doesn't preclude you from addressing it later during questions, but I mean, as long as we have Julia's attention, does anybody have questions about just the data itself?
I have a question about procedure. So you get a call from the sheriff's department or from the state police by someone who's been arrested and needs to be arraigned. Is their first thought to go to the court in which the charge is laid?
Yes.
So before you assign somebody in another court, the home court is either unavailable because everybody knows it's unavailable or has been called and is unavailable. Is that right?
That is correct. And usually when I'm called, I'm not called by a law enforcement agency. I'm usually called by the judge.
Or a clerk, yeah.
Or a clerk.
Right.
If it's during the day, if it's after hours, it's usually called by a judge. So just, by then, the judge is already picked.
But just to be clear, this last slide, last graphic, which mm-hmm. is a compilation, in a way, of what preceded, the two slides preceded. Let's look, for example, at Caroline,
uh-huh.
where there were 17 after-hour arraignments.
Uh-huh.
Some of those may have been charges laid in Caroline.
Uh-huh.
Okay. What would be useful to know, for me, would be how many of those were Caroline charges, and for each of the courts.
So out of the 17, you want to know how many out of the 17 remained and were actual Caroline
right.
crimes?
Because there is an allocation of burden here, and it would be nice to know which courts come closest to meeting their burden as opposed to those courts which are taking on burden for other courts, in effect.
And we have just started keeping that, Mark. We are called now. When we're called, they say to us, I'm calling in an after-hours arraignment that was done in Dryden for Lansing. I'm calling in a case that was done, we had a case last night that was done in Dryden for Lansing. So that they're making that notation now, and we're trying to keep track of that now.
Forward that to us on some timely basis. You know,
yes.
You can pick a month, pick 2 months, whatever.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Liz, sure.
You had all the expenses for mileage, but is it you didn't put in costs for the actual person who's you know, the assigned counsel, is that because they're on salary? Or, I mean...
They're paid by the hour.
Okay.
They're paid $60 an hour for misdemeanors, $75 for felonies. I didn't break that down because I don't know. Sometimes they'll sit in court for an hour. Sometimes they'll sit in court for 3 hours. On a Monday night in Dryden, when there's pretrials, there can be 20 attorneys being called into the court at 4 o'clock. Now, they're all not going to appear at 4 o'clock. And they sit there. Sometimes they're the last one, and they've sat there for hours. And that time is all being charged to county taxpayers.
Do you have any clue about how much that adds up to?
Well, didn't you just say...
Well, it could add up another $50,000 to the budget.
Okay.
And that's just for waiting time.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Julia, has there been any thought to, and I know you do this sort of informally, in a way, but of just actually assigning particular assigned counsel to a particular court rather than have them go to Groton and Dryden. You just have three or four attorneys who just do Groton or just do Dryden.
And we have talked about that, Glenn. The problem with that is I don't have anyone within 45 minutes or 40 minutes who lives by Groton or Dryden. The other thing is, that's unfair to the attorneys. That kind of gives some of the cases to just one bunch of attorneys. The other thing is, they may not be qualified in that area. So we have talked about that. And I do want to say another thing. Jim is the interim supervising attorney. He is not going to be the permanent supervising attorney, as much as I would like that. But so it's going to be someone new. And when the next supervising attorney comes on, the first issue that we're going to talk about is counsel at first arraignment. It needs some tweaking. It needs to be looked at a little bit more closely. And that's one of the things that we're going to look at and talk about. So that's on the agenda to be looked at. And obviously we're going to explore that.
That's helpful. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Betty, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
One real quick question, Julia. It's my. You said that the assigned counsel also works on holidays, which we do as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they get called out on a holiday, are they paid by the state?
Yes.
And how much is that?
They're paid. If it's a holiday, we have 11 holidays in the calendar for the county. And there are 11 holidays that we pay them for. If they're on call for that day, we pay them $250.
And the state reimburses the county?
Yes.
Is that how it works?
We currently have a grant for that, and when the grant runs out, that will run out also.
Would you, I beg your pardon. So the $250, are they paid that on top of, if
yes.
they are actually called out, then they're paid their hourly rate? And
they are.
Okay. In terms of the, let me follow up. How is that determined? Do you have like a rotating list of folks?
We do. Every month, there is one attorney assigned per day for 24 hours. And usually I try to do it by alphabetical, but people have vacations, things going on. We shuffle it around to the attorney's schedule. And try to accommodate them as best we can. But we try to make it that they're on call for one day a month, if we can.
Does that include, it's just holidays, or does that include Saturdays and Sundays?
It includes 365 days a year, every day.
So if somebody is on call, they get that $250 per diem?
Only for a holiday.
Oh,
only for the 11 holidays of the year.
Okay.
But Saturday and Sunday is uncompensated except for actual time if they expend it?
Yes.
I was curious about the travel time calculation. Do you have a standard travel time that you ascribe to every court, or do you just allow the attorneys to specify? How'd you come up with 13 minutes or 20 minutes?
Well, we came up with that by, we Googled it from our office, which is the central location where most of the attorney's offices are located. and we took that timeframe. And some of them are maybe longer. I mean, some of our attorneys live in Trumansburg and have offices in Trumansburg, so the cost may be more. This is just a basic
Now, that
cost.
Could be more as well, or less, depending. For instance, say there's an attorney that's has an appearance in Dryden and one in Ulysses. Mm-hmm. And they live in Groton. Mm-hmm. Okay? So you have that attorney appearing in Groton. Mm-hmm. Now, they get mileage from Groton to Dryden. Mm-hmm. And then from Dryden to Ulysses. Do they get mileage from Ulysses back home?
Yes, absolutely.
So, and I know this is kind of getting out into the weeds perhaps, but if there were simply a better scheduling established by the local courts so that they were more coordinated, have you tried to calculate what that could do in terms of savings for the assigned counsel program?
I have not determined how much, because I wouldn't know what they would schedule it for, but obviously Monday nights would help and Wednesdays would help. If you...
I guess what I'm trying to get at
I mean, if you look at the schedule, like I said, those two courts, Judge Klein is there twice, he shouldn't be, but those two courts right there for Dryden and Ithaca on Wednesday, we have probably 15, I mean, which is why a lot of attorneys aren't here on a Wednesday because they're in Dryden or Ithaca Town Court. There has to be maybe between 15 and 20 attorneys there on any given night on a Wednesday.
What I'm trying to get at is even if we were to recommend a more streamlined and coordinated scheduling of the courts, would that actually result in any appreciable overall savings as compared to, say, centralized arraignment or a dedicated court?
I think it would. I'm not sure what the number would be, but I think it would definitely help. It would also help with the attorneys.
I think there's two things to consider there. Part of the cost is the cost of having attorneys stacked up, 10, 15, 20 deep in a courtroom.
Right.
And you're having a centralized court or some sort of rescheduling so that, four attorneys at 4:15, four attorneys at 4:30, something like that, could help to alleviate that problem and those costs. The mileage time and mileage costs, I think, are going to stay pretty much the same if you have the same number of courts. But the cost saving there would be if we had a central municipal court. Most of the attorneys are downtown. Most attorneys would be, staying to do court at 6 o'clock, and they're not going to incur any mileage time or mileage distance, and there'd be a cost savings there.
Right. So, in other words, simply coordinating the town court schedules is not going to solve that particular part of the problem.
Correct.
Anybody else have other questions concerning the data itself? We can always revisit it, but we'd like to hear from Lance Salisbury, who is a longtime practicing attorney in town, well-respected and loved, and we'd love to hear what you have to say, please.
Thank you, Ray. Thank you, members of the task force. Let me start with actually just a couple quick comments to some of your questions before I go into my comments, to follow up on a couple of questions that were raised. One is, in terms, I think it was Ms. Thomas asked, how long we attorneys normally sit, like in Dryden. Typically, on an ADA night, the district attorney's office is only in a town court once a month. In Dryden and Ithaca, normally on a DA's night, from my experience, each attorney's sitting for an hour plus, and you're billing for that. It can vary. Some are there longer, some a little shorter, but I don't think I've ever been there, except on unique occasions when it hasn't been at least an hour, or typically longer. Other courts are different. Judge Poole's court, I'm typically in and out of there fairly quickly. But in answer to those big courts, yeah, there's some significant waiting time there. In terms of the question on bail, it's hard because as attorneys, we don't oftentimes see how long it takes clients to bail out. But my experience is it depends. If there's a family member, sometimes it's a little faster. But oftentimes, if, for instance, if they're waiting to get to have OAR process them to see if they can assist with bail, or if they're even waiting on family and so forth to try to get released, it's typically, I believe, at least a couple days. And it depends on scheduling, because OAR is only at the jail certain hours, can only meet with so many people. So if you come in on a Friday night, you're not going to see OAR until Monday or Tuesday. But if you come in on a Monday, I would still think typically it seems like it's a couple days before they rotate out. But and it depends. Some are longer, some are shorter. But just to give you a sense of that, and then in terms of travel time, my experience is I think most attorneys are billing their actual travel time. I know that's what I do. So for me, because of where I live in the county, my travel time to Lansing or Dryden is in mileage is lessened because I live in that. So I only bill from like the court. You know, it's reduced, whereas to Ulysses it's greater because I'm going farther. But I believe most attorneys bill actual travel. We kind of know what that is. We've indicated that, or you know, we figured that out. But our actual the actual cost on that. So my comments tonight are intended to kind of be an addendum to the letter I submitted. I don't want to take you through that entire letter, but if that's raised questions, you know, please feel free to ask me questions on that. I'd like to make a couple quick points about the letter before I start. The first is that submission is my work alone. I actually had a colleague review it, and they had some questions. They asked me if because of some of my discussion in there about Ithaca City Court, if Judge Miller had given me input. And my answer is no. He hadn't seen that before I submitted it, and I'm not sure if he would totally appreciate some of the suggestions I have in terms of Ithaca City Court and workload. But that's my thinking and not contributions from him or anyone else on that, just to make that clear. And just a second note, I realized upon reflection, I noted there that it's possible, for instance, that a 16 or 17-year-old can be sentenced under some circumstances by a non-lawyer judge up to a year in jail. Upon reflection, in certain circumstances, a 16 or 17-year-old who's non-YO eligible, who has multiple misdemeanors, could actually be sentenced up to 2 years in jail. So which is significant on that. But so with those points, let me move on to my comments. And I think you see from my letter, my interest here is based on my professional experience outside the county, as well as my professional experience as attorney here in Tompkins County. And initially, I think, you know, my view of the town courts is that, as I noted in my letter, I think the vast majority, and I indicate a vast majority because there are a few newer judges that I don't practice in front of, so I don't really know them, tend to be decent people that are trying to work hard at the craft. I mean, I think there are limits there. For many of them, it's a second occupation. They're taking that on in addition to a primary occupation they have or have had. On that, and I think we can recognize there are some judges, and I think others have spoken of this. I mean, we have some here who are very good judges, who do a good job, but that's by itself isn't sufficient. And you'll notice in my letter, I ultimately came to the conclusion that there is a need for consolidation of some type here. And the reason for that is, I believe, based upon my professional experience, that the key requirement of a criminal justice system is the need to have a fair and equitable process. And it's the process that is the key there, and that the mandate of our criminal justice system has to be that the process protects the due process and the rights of individuals to be treated fairly and equitably within the system. And unfortunately, what we see is we have great disparity and inequity between the courts in the county. And so that we have some people who are doing good work and working very hard, but the overall picture is one of disparity in treatment of individuals, and that undermines the system as a whole. And that's one of the reasons I came to the conclusion that I did, that there needs to be some consolidation, is that you can't have a system that treats people within the county with vast differences in terms of the equity of the process based upon simply the geographic location of where they get charged, which in some cases, you know, 100 feet can make a difference in that. And that's a tremendous problem for the system. And I think that's the mandate is you can't mandate results, and that's not what I'm suggesting, but you can mandate that the process be fair and equitable. And I think that...
And uniform?
In uniform. And that's how you get equity and due process. And if you have that, then I think everyone can live with and accept the results. Even defendants, I found, if they feel like they've been treated fairly by the system, they're more accepting of what happens to them. Yet, even when I've had clients go off to state prison, but they feel like they were treated fairly, and so they can accept what happens. And that's one of the big issues, I think, that people have, is that there's inequities in the process there. And I notice you see that throughout the process, from bail all the way through sentencing. So I'll leave that for questions if you have questions about certain aspects. But I'll let those inequities not only affect individuals in the system, but they also impact on the county in terms of costs, in policies, and sometimes they work counter to the process itself. I can give you a quick example in terms of bail, because we've had those discussions. And I've experienced this myself as an on-call attorney just twice within recent months. A typical charge, and I'm going to come back to it in terms, again, of fines issues, are a charge we call aggravated unlicensed operation third, which basically what that means is somebody's driving on a suspended license. In my experience, the majority of those cases are there are people who have had traffic tickets that for some reason, oftentimes are unpaid fines or sometimes a failure to appear. There can be a variety of reasons, but the largest category I have as clients tend to be among the indigent and working poor are people who have been unable to pay those fines and find themselves having to drive, getting stopped, ticketed for having a suspended license and ended up in court. One of the problems with bail and one of the inequities here that I'll use this as an example of is the purpose of bail primarily is to ensure, and there are a few kinds of exceptions you can talk about, but the overall purpose of bail is to ensure that a charged defendant returns to court. The problem is you get inequity in that within our town courts, because some courts seem to see it as a detentive or punitive measure to be used within the criminal justice system. with individuals who are as a matter of law, considered innocent until convicted, so that you get bail being used inappropriately. In AUOs, found it comes into effect because of the nature of AUOs, the policy of the district attorney's office here, I think rightfully so, which is in line with most district attorneys in upstate New York, is those cases get adjourned out for a period of months to allow the individual to work on rectifying the underlying reasons for the suspension, and then they come back into court, and typically there's a reduced plea, and the issue is resolved. The goal of the district attorney's office in the court generally is you want to see people get a valid license. I've had cases where, unfortunately, I referred to where you come in and the judge wants to set bail at $5,000 or $6,000 on someone who's working poor. It undermines that process because they can't make that bail, and it's overly steep for that type of misdemeanor crime, unless there's something unusual on an AUO third.
Ed?
Yes, two in the last 2 months. And those are examples where it's not only probably inappropriate bail in terms of bail itself, but it also works counter to the whole policies that the system sees, the DA and everyone sees how you resolve this. Because if you put someone in bail, they're not going to get out of jail on that high a bail if they're indigent and poor.
Was there an attorney present?
Yeah, I was the attorney present. That's how I know those cases occurred. I was able to talk the bail down somewhat, but still, it was thousands of dollars. That's just an example of the type of inequities that you run into there. The other issue I wanted to talk about, and then use this to jump into, is the issue, one of the problems that needs to be addressed with the existing system is the issue of fines and surcharges, payments of fees that come with courts. The problem is, in terms of town courts, Ithaca City Court being the exception, is they generally do not accept partial payments because there are inabilities there. There are limitations on some of these courts in terms of their ability to handle these. In some courts, even with full-time clerks, won't accept partial payments. The result is with the indigent and the working poor is you can have people who owe several hundred dollars or more. In the case of a DWI, the fees and surcharges can be at least $600, $700, up to over $1,000 on misdemeanors. If you're indigent or the working poor, where you qualify for assigned counsel, the requirement is, and I've had DWIs where they owe $1,200, $1,300, $1,400, and the judge says, you have 30, 60 days to pay that. There's no way they can have those funds themselves. And what we do then is we help precipitate the process with AUOs where they don't pay that, they get suspended, they then get caught and charged. So we help create that circular process where we're creating more criminal conduct simply because people can't pay that. The other thing that happens, practically speaking, is people can't pay that. They're afraid to come back to court to tell the judge, I can't pay that. The reality is many judges may be willing to work with them, but many people are afraid of being in trouble with the courts. So they get caught in this system, and we end up creating a couple of things happens. They get licenses suspended. They end up with AUO thirds, criminal misdemeanor charges, and they're back in court. Or they keep getting violated on probation or their conditional discharges. The attorneys get called back into court. That creates additional costs for assigned counsel. We create additional work that in part is due. Now part of that is some people are not gonna, some people you have, there are always some who are difficult. But a lot of these people are simply caught in this system where they can't pay. I have multiple clients who tell me, I was saving the money, and then I had a child get sick, or I had this happen, or I had that, and I had to use the money for that, and now I have to start over, and I don't have the money. So that's another problem that really needs to be addressed within the system, is this inability or unwillingness of some courts to accept partial payments. And it's you know, there are some courts who have part-time clerks. It's difficult for them to probably to process these payments. But there has to be some way, and that's one of the reasons why I came to the conclusion consolidation can help address that. And you know what I say in my letter, any type of consolidation that occurs, there has to be that ability, that partial payments. For instance, the city court has partial payments, and if you're paying, they let you go. If you stop paying at some point, then they're going to, you know, want to see that individual back in court. And Judge Miller could probably fill you in much better on that than I can. But that's a key issue here. Two other areas I wanted to address, and then I'll leave it to questions.
Try to be brief so we can
get to your questions.
All right.
Two key areas that I think there has to be consolidation, as I noted in my letter. Those are veterans in DWIs. Veterans, and I'll note, I think in the media somewhere there was a reference to hundreds of veterans being incarcerated in Tompkins County. I think that was a stenographic error. It's actually a much smaller number at any one time, which actually means it's easier for consolidation to occur. But I found that as a group, and I guess my feeling is this is a group that frankly has earned the right to have their special needs considered by the courts through their service. They've earned that privilege. And I found, unfortunately, in my experience, the courts I've had for the most part have been unwilling to recognize or haven't recognized that many of these people have special needs. There are a number of special programs and so forth that can address those. By consolidating that with one court, you allow for those needs to be identified and processed. You don't need to create a special veterans court. You can create essentially a veterans part in a court, which accomplishes the same thing. The second thing is, there's a need to consolidate DWIs because this is where you have some of the greatest inequity in process, in sentencing, in treatment. And frankly, you have in some courts illegal sentences occurring. And those judges seem unwilling to change that. And that shouldn't occur. That's one of the most, I think, dramatic instances where 100 feet can change dramatically the type of treatment you get and the type of sanction you get, irrespective of you as an individual. You shouldn't have a preset sentence. Your sentence should be based upon the particular facts of the case and you as an individual. And I think a DWI part is particularly mandated because that's an area of the law that's getting increasingly complex, more requirements, structures are being put in place on a regular basis by the state. That makes it, I mean, the amount of paperwork now that comes with a DWI is really onerous, particularly for a town court with a part-time clerk. It's really extreme. And I think, and frankly, I'll say this as a defense attorney, there are some town courts where I can get much more lax treatment of a DWI client than if we consolidated it in front of, for instance, Judge Miller, who does the misdemeanor DWI part. Yet I have some issues with some of his sentences, but you get more fair and equitable process, and I think that's the requirement, and there's a great need to consolidate those cases as well. And in my letter, I noted how that's being done, for instance, in Kings County and some other locations. And I'll end there to allow for questions, and thank you.
Thank you, Lance. And why don't we can go from right to left or left to right, or if any panel member would like to start it off. Glenn, go ahead.
Lance, one of the issues you raised in your letter was that because of the complexity of some of the cases, particularly when they're misdemeanors or jury trials or felonies, more jailable sorts of offenses as far as sentence, that maybe sometimes non-lawyer judges aren't appropriate to sit on those cases. And the one thing that sort of struck me was that there is a provision, or a couple of provisions under 170 in CPL, that allows a defense attorney to ask the court, a non-lawyer judge, to take him or herself off the case and have the case transferred to a lawyer judge. That doesn't happen very often. In fact, I only know of one instance where that occurred, and that was quite a while ago. And I know it's discretionary, but what if the judges agreed in advance that if you want a non-lawyer judge off the case and a lawyer judge assigned by the county court, so the defense attorney wouldn't know what judge is going to get that case, so the judge shopping angle is diminished dramatically. That's solved that problem?
I think, I've thought about that because it's come up hearing this. I'm not sure, because my experience in talking with other attorneys, I think one of the reasons that doesn't occur is there's a fear, whether real or not, of that if an attorney does that, they're going to have issues with that judge in the future with other cases, so that the problem, because if I do that once, I'm going to have to do that with every case before that judge or that court, simply because I have concerns about then future clients and how, what'll happen. And I think there also been some concerns about, well, then are we going to overload certain courts that have lawyer judges? And you're going
to get... It wouldn't necessarily have to be a town or a village justice.
Judge.
It could be a county court.
County court judge. And I think, I know there's some... I think that's, practically speaking, one of the reasons you haven't seen that is attorneys are afraid of what happens to my other clients, my ability to represent them effectively in front of those judges, and does that in other judges as well, if I start doing that. I know that there's been, and I don't want to speak for those judges, but I know, I've been told by county court judges in terms of like bail review, says, look, you can't be bringing every case in front of me for bail review. There has to be something egregious that happens. I simply can't be spending all my time reviewing every bail decision by a local judge. I think there may be some reluctance within the system of what are you doing? I think if you start to see more of that, it may be you open the dam, and you get a flood of that. But I think, practically speaking, that's why it hasn't occurred. I can't speak for all attorneys, but that's my sense from talking to people. There's been some concern about what happens, with these courts. But perhaps that's something that needs to be reexamined.
I'm actually a little surprised that defense attorneys are all that concerned about insulting the judge or whatever.
I suspect
it tend to have fairly thick skin.
Yeah, I think it's more of a concern of my sense is it may not be so much insulting the judge as can I represent future client? What happens to my future clients in front of that judge? Are they going to suffer? That's my sense of it. I mean, it's not, and that's not, I haven't done a great deal of examination in that area.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Any other questions? Yes, Liz.
Looking at the weekly court schedule, it seems like what I've been hearing a couple times is if we consolidated that there would be a full-time court or something. But, I mean, that would be way more than what we have now. Is that what we're talking about? Is it something more full-time, right?
Right.
So that's more accessible?
And I was thinking, like, for instance, I had, talk about district court, but if you were to consolidate into a couple of town courts, I think There are a couple of, you know, thinking through that, a couple of options are, for instance, because you're from Ulysses, let's say we incorporate Ulysses with a couple other towns. One of the benefits maybe then is that money gets pooled so that salaries for the judge and clerk are increased. That may affect who can and or is willing to serve, but it can become more of a, you can expect then greater operations by that court in terms of time, so that then you could address some of those issues instead of, for instance, everyone showing up at Dryden Town Court at 5 or at 4. You know, there's, let's say it's in operation from 1 to 5. You break that up so attorneys are coming. Similarly, you know, with county court, you know, I have an appearance at 2:30, someone else, you know, is at 2:45 or 3, that type of thing.
Are you noticing with the courts that only have one night, are they far more congested than the courts that have two days a week where they offer court? Is that?
Yes, I mean, I think part of this, the most congestion occurs in Dryden and Ithaca Town Court, because they handle most of the cases. A lot of the congestion, Monday night's bad because you tend to bounce around the county. So there's a lot of work there. It Wednesday can be an issue as well. Some of the smaller courts, there's less congestion because they have fewer cases, so it handles. If a court has 10 cases that night, it doesn't take as long, obviously, to get through.
So it seems like the way that it is now, that most of the smaller towns that have smaller caseloads, the congestion is sort of the same across the different courts.
Well, let me. And if I have misunderstood you and I'm answering wrong, correct me. I think most of the congestion occurs in Dryden, in Ithaca. A lesser extent, Ulysses on ADA nights can be busy and will have, I'm thinking of Judge Schley's court, that's the night court. There can be 8 or 9 attorneys there. I mean, that courtroom's packed there as well. And he tends to be fairly efficient, you know, tries to work through stuff fairly efficiently. So the congestion there may be a little less because of numbers. But so there's less congestion, I think, you know, in Enfield Town Court moves fairly efficiently, but I think some of these other courts, Newfield can be somewhat congested. I'm there less often, so it's harder for me to speak, but I think my impression, Danby, the smaller courts, you don't have the congestion because you don't have the, what creates the congestion is the caseload number of attorneys in terms of the attorneys sitting there. People sit there for hours if they're unrepresented, but because generally the courts try to move the attorneys through first because they know they're paying, you know, the cost issues.
I have more questions, but I don't want to.
Why don't we just pass on?
Yes.
And come back to you, Liz.
Yep.
All right.
I have a number of questions, so if you want to move down that way.
Actually, I want to address something because I think it'll bring in the assigned counsel folks as well, and I want to. You make a comment in your letter that there are not many trials or hearings in the local courts because of the concern of inconsistent results or less than legally learned results. That's not your language,
right,
but that's what you're suggesting. What I'm curious about is, do we have the statistics as to just misdemeanors, whether they're DWIs or other, as to how many of those cases, or even per case, you know, how many hearings are actually being conducted in the local courts, hearings and trials?
You mean hearings such as suppression, things like
suppression
that?
Suppression hearings, geographical jurisdictional hearings, felony hearings, trials. I'm just curious what, you know, how many of these hearings actually happen as opposed to, you know, people basically, lawyers coming, negotiating resolutions,
I don't have
and
the
things
statistic.
Happen without that.
I don't have the statistic on hearings, but I do. I can get the one for trials for you, for the local courts.
Well, it sounds like there aren't very many trials in any.
There are
of the
not
local
very
courts.
Many trial jury trials in the justice courts. There are not.
But I'm even all right if they're non-jury, as long as they. I'm interested at the misdemeanor level, not the traffic offense level, but at the misdemeanor level, or above. So I guess a felony hearing. I'm curious as to, in fact. It'd be very interesting to know, say, in 2014, how many of these hearings actually happened anywhere in the local courts. And then I'd be curious to know whether there was a distinction in the saturation rate between those that are in front of, say, lawyer-trained judges versus those that are not in front of lawyer-trained judges. Because I'm just curious about that comment that you made, Lance. And I know you're speaking anecdotally, but do you have any further information you can shed on that?
I think, and again, it'll be based on my experience and others, I think, and one of the things maybe, and Judge Miller may be able to get his staff here, but my perception is you'll find, just as a comparison, there's a far higher number of suppression hearings in trials in Ithaca City Court, you know, as a local court compared to the town courts, compared to the town courts.
You attribute that to attorney decisions?
In large part, yes.
Volume?
I think if you, because that can, you have to kind of clear for that noise, you know, in terms of volume. But I think even if you looked at percentages, my suspicion is it would be higher there because the decisions made, based on my experience, in proceeding to whether you proceed to a hearing or a trial in a town court is based on a couple of factors by attorneys. The court and the nature of the offers that are coming from the DA's office, which can vary between courts as well, which can help resolve that. But it's anecdotal, but based over my years of experience, I know that there are courts where attorneys are reluctant to push those cases because they don't believe that the process is going to allow the client a fair shake at being heard, and the end result is going to be rather draconian. And oftentimes, when that's explained to the client's like, "I'm not doing that yet." I'm not willing to take that risk.
So do you think a fair comparison would be just simply, I think I heard you say this, but I want to make sure this is accurate. If we were to somehow figure out whether collectively or individually the percentage of cases in which there was some kind of a fact-finding hearing in the local courts presided over by non-lawyer judges versus the percentage in, say, something like lawyer presided over town judges or town courts, and or city court, which clearly are, but again, percentage, so that
right.
That takes care of the load factor.
Oh, yeah.
And you think that'd be an interesting comparison?
I think it would be. And, you know, I don't know the answer. I just kind of know from interacting with attorneys why they're making decisions.
Because presumably the policies of the district attorney, if they're uniform, would be the same kinds of offers would be made.
The assistant district attorneys are given great leeway in the town courts they handle in terms of the offers they're making in their policy. Within, they're broad parameters, but they vary a great deal.
Okay, so that's obviously a wild card in all this.
I was going to say, I think you might recall Judge Ravo's testimony where he was, you know, his district attorney, assistant district attorney, treated petty shoplifting, small shoplifting, different from everybody else.
No, that's correct. I stand corrected on that. That's correct. All right, I'll pass.
I'll pass.
Mark? Jason?
Have you had any cases where a client was brought into court for failure to pay a fine and then they were subsequently incarcerated for failure to pay that fine?
I was trying to think. And I think there have, I'm aware of where there have been cases, and I'm aware of that issue because one is because if it's simply a surcharge, they can't do that, and that's occurred.
Excuse me, Lance, I can answer that better than you.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I have clients all the time who are picked up on warrants because they have not paid the fine and they have gone to jail.
Is that because bail was not set on them, or after a hearing?
After the decision is made on what the fine is going to be, they're given X amount of days in which to pay the fine. The day passes and they haven't paid it. They're picked up on a warrant and they say, you still owe X amount of dollars, and they've been put in jail. I think that OAR, I wasn't here when OAR testified, but I think that Deb Dietrich alluded to the fact that there was some, it's like a debtor's prison sometimes, that does happen. And Deb had some instances, I don't want to speak for Deb, where the fine money was taken for, the bail money was taken for the fine, which shouldn't have occurred, and that did get straightened out with OAR, but that has been occurring.
And I can speak a little to add on to that, and this is there's a difference between town courts. There are some town courts, they have people come back and they say, look, here's you haven't paid, what's going on, and we'll try to work with those individuals. You have other town courts where that's, you know, it's you haven't paid, it jail. So you get, there's a vast difference there again. That's one of the issues that you're getting with
courts. Any of these courts use what I know commonly occurs in city court is issuing a confession of judgment.
Most, in my experience, that's been raised by attorneys, most town courts are not willing to issue confessions of judgments, which would be a simple way to do that. What a confession of judgment does, I think most people on the panel probably understand that it becomes a civil judgment against that individual that's filed with the county and then can be taken, like any kind of judgment, out of wages from a paycheck. But that's, most town courts won't consider that.
Do they give a reason why?
The answer I've typically gotten is we don't do that.
If the person then can't pay, do they at that point decide to hold a hearing on whether or not it's willful non-payment?
Most don't. That's been raised. I've seen that raised. I haven't really seen an effective hearing or consideration of that. That doesn't say it hasn't occurred in a town court. It just, in my experience, I have not seen that. And that's my sense is it does not happen.
The hearing doesn't happen?
That a hearing and a real consideration of the economic ability of an individual to pay. Or else, I've had situations where you'll explain what their economic situation is and the judge says, I don't consider that sufficient or compelling.
How many days are they sentencing the individual to serve?
In some cases, they see that as a violation of a conditional discharge on a misdemeanor. They'll try to resentence them. You know, they're I want to be careful because in case my memory's flawed, but my sense is months in cases. I mean, because if they do it in that regard, if you're on a year-long conditional discharge on a misdemeanor, say you haven't paid your fines, you violated the conditional discharge, I'm resentencing you, that can be up to a year on an A misdemeanor. But
without a hearing?
Well, at times, and I want to be careful because And sometimes is the argument is made by the attorney that they're indigent, they can't pay the fines. Sometimes the courts aren't willing to allow for a more formal presentation to document that. So it's a weakness. It may be a weakness, perhaps. If I was going to say, work with attorneys may need to do a better job on it being more aggressive in that area. But it's also there is an issue with courts not really holding the proper hearings and really listening to that evidence. And again, it varies. I don't want to paint all town courts with the same brush. It's kind of that same issue I've been talking about. You get different courts handle that differently, and there's you get inequity in some of these courts. And
but the answer on that is, I mean, I think it's been alluded to, is simply if the person cannot pay, then it would be unconstitutional for the court to resentence the person to incarceration. If the court did it, A, if they did it without building a proper record or allowing a proper record, you'll get reversed on appeal and it'll go back and a record will be recreated. And B, if they did allow a proper record and it did establish inability, then presumably our county judges who are lawyer trained would reverse that. I think the bigger issue is making sure that the attorneys who are representing these people, in fact, make sure that happens.
Right. No, and I address, and that's why I said there may be a need yet for that to occur.
Well, the thing is, even with all that, though, your damage is already likely to have been done because the defendant, the client, may have already lost their job because they were picked up on a warrant. The county, as the taxpayer, I mean, to me, having to pay the attorneys to file these motions with the county court, to appear on them, to pay for the cost of the person to spend that overnight if in jail or multiple nights. And how big are these fines? I mean, the biggest ones I know of are the DWI fines.
Right.
So what we're talking about a lot of times are fines that are probably under $500. And by the time you run through this, if you have an issue, we've blown past $500 just on the system costs.
Right. No, that's
almost
true.
Like, to me, it's just speaking as a taxpayer, why are we wasting money on these things when the answer is simply confession of judgment?
No.
And why aren't more courts using the tool?
No, that's a fair point, and it may become the subject of further discussion. But we get these inequities not just in non-lawyer trained judge courts. We get these inequities in lawyer trained judge courts as well.
Yeah.
And actually, kind of segues when you said that many of the DWI sentences are illegal. They're illegal only because there are preordained. I think that's the point you were making.
Correct. That's correct.
You plead and this is the sentence if you plead to this particular result. But that happens in city court as well as in some of the town courts.
No. I don't mean to. Let me explain the difference. Is what happens in a few of the town courts, because it's really limited to a few of the town courts, with DWI sentences, you get typically two results. There could be a conditional discharge, which basically has some requirements in it, but no reporting issues, or probation for 2 or 3 years. And there are some town courts that have a preset policy of if you get a conditional discharge or if you get a DWAI reduction, there are certain policies outside of Ithaca City Court where they'll reduce based on the BAC to a DWAI that say, you're automatically getting set number of weekends in jail. And it's just a standardized policy. And that's what's improper. You can't have that, a preset sentence. It's not, because it's not, the law requires, it has to be an individualized sentence. You know, I think you're aware, per defendant. And what happens in Ithaca City Court, as part of the, in the DWI part now, there are a couple of things that happen. If there is a reduction from simply getting a conditional discharge will never come automatically with a jail sentence. Now, based on the individual and their history and the nature of the incident, that may occur. But that's fine. There is, in terms of the reductions, if it's in the policy level of the district attorney, it's 0.12 in terms of the BAC. If it's below that, there'll be a reduction. There's no typically no jail time. There is a DWI part now there, if you're between a 0.12 and I think it's a 0.18, you can negotiate a reduction with the district attorney's office that typically comes with a requirement of, to a DWAI, with a requirement of a jail sentence left to the discretion of the court somewhere between, I think it's typically 5 to 15 days, something like that. And so it's not preset. And there are some cases based on the facts or the legal issues where, you know, I've had at least one of those where it'll occur with no jail time. So it's a little different. I understand what you were saying, Ray, but it's not a preset sentence. It's dependent upon the plea bargaining process and the facts of the case. It's an important qualitative difference.
But how is that different than, say, from one of the courts, I don't wish to name a particular court, but say a town court that doesn't, that where you think they're running afoul of that?
Well, because what's happening there is saying if you have a conditional discharge, then you're getting 3 weekends in jail. That's just everyone who gets a conditional discharge gets 3 weekends in jail. It's a priest
on a plead guilty as charged or on a reduced?
On either. And typically what happens, let's say it's a DWI with a conditional discharge. Typically there's a, because you're charged with two counts, typically. You plead to one.
Right.
So it's a kind of a plea as charged. It's automatic. It doesn't matter who the defendant, their history, the egregiousness of the incident or lack thereof. It's just preset, and that's the issue, is that there's no considerate, you know, nothing particularized to the individual.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Betty. You had some other questions.
Yes, I did. One for Julia. You indicated that you thought a centralized court would be a good idea, given that it would save a lot of travel time, et cetera, for your attorneys. Do you think, or better yet, wouldn't that create even more of a backlog, so to speak, because you've got county court, you've got city court, you've got family court, you've got IDV court, you've got drug court. Now, if you had a district court, are you going to have enough attorneys?
It depends on what the schedule would be. I mean, I would think, hopefully, that a centralized court would be more stretched out, that you would have an attorney come in at 1:45. He has five cases. He's got 30 minutes. Then the next attorney would be scheduled at 2:15. I'm not going to have that five or six attorneys coming in at 1:45, sitting there waiting for their time to be called.
Okay.
I think that's where there's going to be a difference.
Okay. All right.
And I wanted to say something else too, Ray. I'm sorry, Betty, but
That's right.
I wanted to say something that we didn't address, either Lance or I, is the fact about full-time clerks in the courts. I'm a person who deals with the clerks every single day. Without the full-time clerks, I could not do my job. They are what keeps my office going. They are what helps me every single day, the full-time clerks. If I did not have Deb in Dryden, she teaches me things. I couldn't do what I do. That is very, very important. They keep the courts running. They keep the paperwork moving along. And without them, the rest of us here could not function. And that is a very, very important part of this, is having a full-time clerk, and I didn't address that in my synopsis.
Suggesting full-time clerks in every town court if the town court system were to continue?
I don't think that's possible, but if there was a centralized court, there would be clerks there that would be full-time. City court has six clerks on any given day, and they handle the amount of work that they have. If there was a centralized court, obviously the clerks would have to be full-time, and that is a very important aspect of the jobs that we do.
I think full-time clerks would be an important thing, but I suspect many of the towns are not willing to bear that cost.
They are not.
Yeah.
Another question.
Okay. You indicated that a lot of the courts don't accept partial payments. There is a bookkeeping dilemma for the town courts, and especially with one part-time clerk. Because when someone comes in and they pay $10, okay, do we apply it to the surcharge first or do we apply it to the fine first? And again, this is a part-time court clerk. I extended out 3-4 months to allow them to pay. I feel as a judge, because I'm giving them that opportunity, and I understand times are tough. If times are tough, I tell them, just contact the court. I'll be happy to work with you. I know a lot of courts don't do that. But by the same token, that in and of itself is a nightmare, and I think that's why you see a lot of courts that don't accept the partial payments, but it will extend the payment time out. Is that something that you would be receptive to?
I have, I know your court does. The problem is many courts don't, but the practical problem is this, and that's why I put in my letter that, because I recognize that issue for some courts, and that's why I said can't or won't, because it differences. I realize those limitations on courts. The practical problem becomes for this, if you're indigent, you know, the working poor is, they're always kind of chasing their tail in terms of just their living costs, so it becomes very difficult for them to build and save that money. It seems like I've had some clients who keep doing that, and then something happens. You know, it's easier for them. I say I can do $20 a month, or I can do this, but it's hard to save. And they'll say, look, I had, you know, my child was sick, we had to go to the doctor, there's a copay. That money, you know, I'm sorry, it went there, you know, or it's this, or so sometimes that helps, but oftentimes it merely extends the process of your, you know.
But it could extend it indefinitely, because I've extended payments out over a year.
Right.
And, you know, we don't have time to track them down, you know, and to keep up on it. So the only other option is to suspend them.
Right. No, I understand that. Or to do, in some cases, a confession of judgment.
A confession of judgment. Right.
Right.
Absolutely.
It eliminates that problem. But that's I recognize the it's an issue for some of these courts, the ability to try to handle the monies. And that's why a confession of judgment is one way. But it's the requirement that they have to pay in full that tends to undermine many of these people who are the indigent. You know, they get caught by that.
And very quickly, I'll be very brief.
No, go ahead, please.
It seems that I'm hearing the same song from testimony as with regard to sentencing courts and not being equitable, not being fair. I'm hearing it, and I'm thinking of a couple of courts, okay, where these same issues occur over and over and over again. You indicated that some of them were illegal sentences.
Right, or what I consider very improper. Better.
However, okay, if that's the case, you as their attorney, don't you have an ethical obligation to report that? I don't think it's right either for a town court to have a policy of, you know, you judge each and every case on its own merits.
Right.
And if you have a judge that is not doing that, I think it's incumbent upon you as their counsel to report them to the appropriate authorities.
No, I agree. And I can't speak for other attorneys whether or not that's occurred. I know what to speak in terms of myself, because I've observed this more than frankly because when you don't have an actual client, it's difficult. You're limited in terms of dealing with the client. Many clients are unwilling to appeal those sentences. One is because effectively the sentence is done by the time the appeal gets heard, or they're afraid. I've had clients say, I don't want to do that. I don't want the judge mad at me. I don't want that to hurt me in the future. You're limited by the client.
If I did something that was not correct, I would want you
right.
to confront me.
Right.
Each judge is different.
And I've talked with, and one of my reasons I raise this, I've had discussions with some judges, and it has had no impact, I guess, as we say.
Okay. Mark had a comment.
Yeah, a lawyer does not have an ethical obligation to report a bad act by a judge generally.
Well, if it affects his client.
It all depends on whether it's advantageous or disadvantageous to the client. And as often as not, it's advantageous to the client. Because, as we've heard time and time again, judges know their people, and their people know their judges. And just as a lawyer, Lance has told us, may be afraid to challenge a judicial decision by a town court judge because of all the other clients who will appear before that judge later, so too a client, resident of the community, may not wish to suggest that the judge is incompetent.
All right, but the counterpoint on that is that oftentimes that kind of an issue, in other words, whether a sentence is proper or not, is not the kind of thing that would be entertained by the Judicial Commission on Misconduct, but rather would be deferred to an appellate court. And then that implicates what Jason had just said.
That's the client's call.
And that's the client's call. All right. I think that's a good point. Unless anybody else has any other points they wish to resolve or address? All right. I want to thank all of you. Lance, that was very helpful, and I appreciate your writing. Julia, your work has been is incredibly useful and detailed, and I'm sure that you'll be available for us to follow up if we have questions on any of this data. And Jim, thank you for not only appearing tonight, but thank you as a member of the bar. Thank you for stepping in and dealing with a very serious issue in a time of need. We really appreciate it. Thank you. All right, with that, quickly, have we added value? Jason left the right tonight. Mark?
Our guests added value.
Well, that goes without. Yes. I agree.
Yes.
Liz?
Yes, thank you.
Glenn?
Yes.
All right, the other folks, for the next meeting, we're scheduled for the 16th. We have, at this time, elected to, we absolutely want to hear from the clerks, and we're going to hear from them in the first part of the year. But for the 16th, we are going to, as a group, discuss where we are and try to kind of take the pulse and see where we want, what further material, data, research we will be looking for going forward. So this is going to be a discussion. I would ask you to please review your notes, review the materials that we've had thus far, and be prepared to, in a way, try to, I'm not saying narrow the issues, but at least help us to focus on some of the areas where we need to do more work, and frankly, some of the areas that we may say, you know, this is, let's not chase that rabbit down that hole. It's a waste of time. So I'd like that kind of discussion to happen in December 16th, and then we'll take it from there. All right? Thank you. We stand adjourned.